From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Thank you for joining me for episode number 122. This week I'm joined by extraordinary woman Brandy Morris. Brandy lives on Bainbridge Island in the state of Washington. She is part of a blended family and she and her husband have raised 5 children, ranging in age from 15 to 26. Brandy has been overweight since childhood and since she was a very young adult has weighed more than 300 pounds at any given time. At the age of 43, Brandy was severely insulin resistant, weighed 325 pounds, was medicated for clinical depression, anxiety and high blood pressure, had PCOS and had started developing painful blood clots in her legs. Now, not quite 2 years later, Brandy's life is completely different thanks to the adoption of the ketogenic dietary model. She has lost 96 pounds so far, has no blood clots and no symptoms of PCOS. Her blood pressure has normalized all on its own, and perhaps most importantly for her, the way of eating has resolved her depression and controlled her anxiety better than any medication she was ever prescribed. She's keto for life. Brandy was one of those people I spot in my Facebook group who sound like they have a great story to tell, and I'm glad I nagged her into coming on the podcast. I hope you enjoy listening to our chat as much as I enjoyed recording it. Welcome, Brandy, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Daisy.
It's nice to see you.
You too.
We've only been chatting for a little while, so it's nice to meet you in person, as it were, across the web waves.
That's right. I feel the same way, thanks. I'm pretty darn excited.
So tell me a bit about you, but I tell you what I want to hear about, because I'm intrigued by it, is where you live.
Oh, sure. So I grew up in the state of Washington, and currently for the last, I don't know, almost 15 years, I guess. 12, 13 maybe. I have lived 7 miles across the water from Seattle, Washington on an island called Bainbridge Island. And it is these days more of a bedroom community for Seattle commuters. You know, they just hop on our state ferry and you know, walk to their offices or grab their shuttles to their offices.
So it's a ferry backwards and forwards.
That's correct. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, it's the most widely used ferry run that we have in the state. So it's pretty crowded.
How big is the island?
The island is geographically roughly the size of Manhattan.
All right.
But we only have, I think the last population demographic I looked at was that we had around 26,000 residents on the island. Mm-hmm. So it's growing, but it's still small, and much of the island is still fairly rural.
That sounds pretty cool.
With little kind of village centers dotted throughout.
So it's changed a bit over the time you've been there.
It has.
It sounds like a different kind of population now.
Yeah, it sure has. So, you know, traditionally there were farmers, Japanese farmers, and some logging industry on the island historically. It was a, you know, obviously it was Native American grounds originally, mm-hmm. but then it became a farming island that had a lot of Japanese farmers. And then during the World War, the Japanese farmers were taken off the island and interred, which was unfortunate. Farming did continue and started back up after the war was over, and some families were able to return. But throughout the 70s, maybe 80s, maybe even earlier than that, I'm not sure exactly. It was kind of an artist's enclave. There's always been around the shoreline a lot of affluence, and people would build their summer homes if they were wealthy individuals from Seattle or something like that. But farming, and lots of authors live on our island. We have a lot of artists on our island. We have a great local art industry. That has quieted down a lot as well. In recent years, with the big tech boom in Seattle, we've seen a big influx of families and people who are, it's a bedroom community for Seattle. It's basically, it's a suburb that's surrounded by water.
Yeah, it changes the vibe. I imagine pushes the prices up as well, which changes the kind of people who are there.
Yeah, it does push the prices up. It's far more expensive than it used to be. There's less economic diversity among the residents than there's ever been. There's less racial diversity than there's ever been on the island. I guess really what's happening is that when you have any kind of major change in demographic and people come to a specific area to work, when your demographics change all at once, your culture changes all at once. Mm. And so people come in with their own cultures, their own social norms. And I think that Bainbridge Island right now, as well as Seattle as a whole, Western Washington as a whole, is really experiencing a time when we're trying to figure out who we are and how best we can live together. And we just have a lot of people coming in with very different cultural norms than, you know, we're here originally. Mm. With that said, I also read an article recently that said that those cultural norms change in the Seattle area every 20 years.
So, oh, right. You know.
Anyway, my mom is European and Native Hawaiian. My dad is European. My grandfather was 100% Native Hawaiian merchant marine from the island of Hawaii, and he moved here at the same time as my Scots-Irish grandmother from Ohio, and they met in a Polynesian music club and had this scandalous marriage and had four kids and raised their babies here. And so I was born in Seattle and have always lived here. And we grew up in a very small town at the foothills of the mountains. It was an economically depressed area. And I was always this fat kid. I went right into being a fat adult when I was, I guess, 20, probably around 20. I weighed in at about 325 pounds, and it never went below 300 pounds, well, until 2 years ago. I think I was one of those active, healthy, if I can say that, fat people. I would go hiking and run around and be active. In high school, I played sports. I was a starting forward on our basketball team. And I was always that outgoing, active, fat girl who had such a pretty face.
Strong, I bet. That's something I noticed. That's something I didn't work on when I lost a lot of weight, actually, because I was always fairly active.
Yes.
Of a similar size, actually. And you don't realize how strong you are because you're doing the things you're doing and you're carrying effectively another person around with you all the time. That's so you're right. Actually really strong.
That's right.
I'm far less strong than I used to be. Should have worked on it on the way down.
That's right.
So why do you think you were carrying that extra weight? Was it to do with what you were eating, or was it, you know, because you were obviously active. You've just spoken about that. Mm-hmm. Presumably there's something to do with your genetic makeup there that had an influence on it.
My sister and I have a joke that when you are partially Native Hawaiian, you're Hawaii-betic. It's just so prevalent.
Yeah.
Within Native communities to contract diabetes and obesity. And that's got a lot to do with colonialism, the types of foods that are introduced when you're colonized to a Native population of people. And so our bodies can't handle all that white rice and all those fried foods. And, you know, I often like to say that Hawaiian food is extraordinarily healthy, but Hawaii food will kill you. It's just junk. And then add to that the fact that, you know, I mentioned that I grew up in an economically depressed town. All of us were so poor that none of us knew we were poor.
Yeah.
We were just a town full of working class people who were growing up in a town supported by an industry that was falling.
Right.
So it was a logging town, and the logging industry fell when we were growing up. So not all of us were poor, but since all of us were poor, none of us knew it. But what that meant was that we ate lots of carbs. You know, we didn't eat out at restaurants and things like that. And my mom always made meals for us, and we were fed well, except that it was potatoes and rice and noodles and gravies and cookies and all of those things that are easy to feed a family on the cheap.
Cheap bulk stuff, isn't it?
That's right. So I was addicted to carbohydrates right out of the gate. It was just the way it was. Also, when I was, I guess I was in third grade, my mom had to take me down to the Macy's, which was the Bon Marché then, and buy me my first bra. And it was a C cup. And I was in third grade. And she bought me a white bra, and then she would put me in white blouses on picture day. And I just wanted to hide. I was way overdeveloped. When I was 12, I looked like I was in my 20s. And I think that I felt a lot of shame around not looking like the other kids. And, you know, I know this sounds perverse, but I can remember hanging out with boys and wanting them to be looking at me. And they were looking at my friends, but their dads were looking at me. And it freaked me out.
I bet.
And I really feel like that one piece of the puzzle is huge. Just developing too early.
Yeah.
Because I just really didn't want people to see me.
Well, it's this weird mix, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not getting attention from the places you want it and getting attention from places that make you feel uncomfortable.
I think that even as very young girls, we understand when something has become sexualized outside of our control, and it doesn't feel good.
No.
Does that make sense?
Totally.
Like, you know, and so like I wanted attention from the boys in an age appropriate way. Does that make sense? And I wanted attention from my friend group and my, you know, I wanted normalized attention, and that just was not something that I was going to get. You know, I can remember there was a gentleman who had some cognitive delays due to a traumatic brain injury living in our town. And I can remember him camping outside of my house when I was 13 years old. He was in his 30s, but he was camping outside of my house to get a glimpse of me because he, you know, he had enough cognitive delays that he just wasn't, he wasn't a predator, but he wasn't connecting that I was a child. So the point to all of that is that I think a lot of the weight that I was willing to tolerate was because I didn't want to experience, you know, if my whole body is the size of my breasts, then my breasts aren't sticking out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a great barrier, isn't it?
Yeah, so I do think that that had something to do with it. And then I got married to my daughter's dad quite young. That was my first marriage. I was married at 18. I gave birth to her when I was 19. And at that point, it was all over in terms of my weight. Within 5 years of having her, I was well over 350 pounds. I don't even know how high I got, but it would not surprise me if it was 375. I just completely shut down around it. Stopped looking in mirrors beyond just my face to apply my makeup. And I lived like that for a long time. When I was 30, my daughter's father and I divorced. And about 5 years later, I met my current husband, my now husband, and I had lost some weight, but I was still like a size 20 US. He had dealt with some depression issues and, you know, and come around in that way. And still was about a size 20 US. And I remained there at about 325 pounds for many years. And I did the typical weight loss programs. I did the shakes. I even at one point got on that Fen-Phen.
I haven't heard of that one.
Craze. I was in my 20s when I did that. And so, you know, and here's the thing. I always felt like I was, I accepted being who I was. I knew that I had something to contribute to the world around me always. I never felt as though I couldn't contribute and have meaningful relationships. And, you know, like I never felt like I could not, like I didn't deserve to have love or, you know, all of these things that people assume are true about fat people just really aren't. We have pretty full lives, even if some people in the world don't think that we deserve it because we're fat. We have pretty full lives. And so I never felt as though I was unhappy being a fat person. I was okay with it. I really was. But then I turned 40 and my depression was getting more severe every year. My anxiety was ramped up all of the time. I lived with a low thrum of it in my gut constantly. I was afraid I was going to have a heart attack any minute. My sister was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. I got a blood clot in my leg, which was not dangerous, but it was extraordinarily painful, and quit my job over it because I just couldn't be on my feet on a concrete floor for 8 hours. Right. And I thought, this has to stop. Even if I'm not vain enough to lose the weight for aesthetic purposes, I'm not going to live long. This, I mean, it really all, even if you are healthy and you're that overweight and you're active and you're that overweight, there is a reckoning physically. And I hit it. I was just exhausted. I would stand at my kitchen sink and do dishes and my lower back would seize up because I didn't have any core strength. It was becoming really untenable. And I didn't want to go on another diet because they didn't work. I would lose 50 pounds and inside 6 months, I would gain it all back.
Yeah, plus a bit more, just for good luck. Yeah.
That's right. And I didn't want to do it again, but I had a friend, a very, very close friend, who had told me 5 years prior about Dr. Jason Fung and how she was doing this Atkins-esque thing, and I really needed to watch them on YouTube. And she was losing weight. And over a 5-year period, She told me about him 5 years before I started keto. And it took me 5 years to look back toward her answer for my own answers. So that's very interesting. And I try to remember that if I'm feeling like I'm not making an impact for other people, like my story isn't impacting other people. It took 5 years for somebody's story to impact me. So that's very important to realize that people come along in their own time and people do what they need to do in their own time.
Well, you often just have to hear it. It's not only a case of hearing it, hearing something at the right time, or it seeping into the level of consciousness it needs to at the right time, but it sometimes needs to be the right person as well. There are all sorts of different factors.
That's right.
It has to be the right time. I understand that frustration of when you know you've got the answer for somebody and they don't want to listen, but you're absolutely right. You've got to wait for their right time.
That's right. So fast forward, you know, 5 years after she kind of started her keto journey, and she started out with, you know, years before, you know, low carb, high fat movement had really taken off. There weren't a lot of resources out there. She started off with Dr. Fung videos before his program existed up there, and the Reddit, the subreddit, the keto subreddits, which cracks me up. Mm-hmm. You know, by the time I was ready to start, there was a lot more resources available. While she bungled through, I bungled through a little less. Mm-hmm. And now people are starting and they have even more resources than I did available 2 years ago. So I started and I just cut out the rice, and it was October of, what is it, 2020 now? I guess it was October of 2017. Mm-hmm. I just cut out the rice and cut out the sugar and I did all that stuff and I started losing weight. But I know I wasn't doing it right. I was doing low carb, but I wasn't ketoing correctly necessarily. And I didn't really get it. I didn't get why I was doing it. I didn't understand any of it. And so, you know, it was maybe 2 weeks that I was like, oh, well, I can have a cup of rice with my dinner every night. I'm still cutting my carbs by this many grams every day. It's fine. And then the holidays rolled around and I was trying to find out more about it, but I still wasn't really getting it. It wasn't clicking. And so I bought the obesity code in March of 2018. And I read that book 3 times in 3 or 4 days. And it all just fell right into place. And I went keto and I've never looked back. So as of today, I have lost 96 pounds.
Wow.
Since March of 2017. I still have some weight to lose. And in fact, during the summer, I started to experience some more ramped up symptoms of perimenopause. And so we've been trying to deal with that a little bit and deal with that with medications, my doctor and I actually put on 7 pounds and it will not budge. When I first started doing keto, I was losing several pounds a month. And now I lose a few ounces a month if I'm lucky, but I'm okay with it. I'm fine. You know, I still have probably 30 or 40 pounds to lose. You know, that's like one of the interesting things about where I was in terms of my denial about my size and my weight is that it's very tough to make concrete goals because you don't know what a healthy weight is. Mm. I don't even know what I look like at 150 pounds. I don't know what I look like at 170 pounds. I just have no idea what that looks like. So I don't set my goals based upon, well, I have this many more pounds to lose, or I have, you know, and then I'll go into maintenance. I'll stop attempting to lose weight and go into total maintenance mode when I don't have a lot of excess fat on my body any longer. And that'll be that. And so I got myself a doctor who is local, who has been treating folks with a ketogenic diet for about 20 years now. And he's been pretty darn supportive in that, you know, if I felt like the weight loss has slowed down enough that starts to give me feelings of anxiety or desperation or some of those feelings that can come on when things slow down. You know, he's very clear, like, this will take you 3 years. Don't worry. There's nothing to worry about. And that's been really positive for me. So now my friend who started me on this journey is, 7 years into her journey. And she has kept off all of her weight. And I have kept off all of my weight and continue to lose. So the next step for me was to start to look at ways that I can improve all of me. I was listening to your podcast episode with Lucy Burns, mm-hmm. and she was talking about the mental health and the mental game around this whole thing. And it just resonated with me so much. It's my mental health and my attitude are the most important pieces for me. We get a lot of garbage thrown at us when we go through major weight loss from the rest of the world. People are unhappy about it. They become incredulous. The terms of your relationships start to change. You have to be able to evaluate and examine the way you see yourself, the way you want to see yourself. And so I started practicing some mindfulness meditation and really kind of unpacking narratives. And that to me right now is the most important piece of the puzzle. So that's really my journey right now. I just want to continue to learn as much as I can all the time and to ensure that the narratives and the storylines that are running in my head are as healthy as they can possibly be, because that is what will create the skill of perseverance within me. Mm. So that's what I'm doing right now. And patience. And, you know, I just wrote a big blog post about resolutions, how I'm all for resolutions in one sense, but not in the form that we typically practice them. They feel very desperate and grabby. Mm. And I don't think that we achieve anything long-term from those types of desperate attempts to alleviate discomfort.
Well, they're those big hope changes, aren't there? It's like when I was talking to Kim and Terry, and Kim talked about that whole planning on a Sunday, what you were going to do when you start on the Monday. And it was this big hope for this change. And it's the little steps that actually make the big difference, isn't it? Yes. Not those dramatic New Year's resolutions that ultimately fall by the wayside most of the time because they're just too much, right, aren't they? It's the little things.
They are. And I think that they come from a place of external, possibly internal, but from a place of pressure that isn't appropriate and it's not healthy much of the time. And so, you know, I would just suggest that, at least for me, my goal is not to lose 50 pounds or to be totally debt-free within 6 months. Or my goals really revolve around practicing living an examined life. I'm resolute in being curious and seeking knowledge and seeking truth and learning to persevere. I think that went for me when I can slow down enough to build healthy narratives in my mind, everything else just falls into place. I don't experience a lot of stress about the fact that my weight loss has slowed down as much as it has. It's just allowed me to really pay attention to my mind, and the narratives in my head has just really allowed me to keep an even keel and to change the way I live my whole life. Keto for me is not a diet. Mm. It's the way I eat. It's just the same as if I were a pescatarian or a vegan or, you know, what have you. It's just the way I live my life. At first, it was a diet, obviously, but now it just isn't. It's just morphed into another thing entirely. And so now my goal is to, you know, always stay mentally focused, but also I've started to have the bandwidth to look at bigger issues that I might be able to contribute to as well. How do we ensure that we are growing and harvesting our food in a responsible way? How do we make sure that our food is as healthy as it can be and not overly processed? What does that look like? How do we do that as a community and as a society? And I, you know, started a little blog and a Facebook group, and I do kind of outreach to mostly people I know who I would really like to kind of bring on board, see them have some improved health. And I did that mainly because I think people were sick of me. Sick of me inundating their Facebook pages, and conversations when we would go anywhere were always about Brandy and keto, and not because I was purposefully dominating conversations that way, but because my entire body has changed. People I have known for years and years and years, my entire adult life, they don't recognize me on the street. Everything has changed. It's so dramatic, and it's just so dramatic that people, there's nothing else on anybody's mind. I wanted to put that somewhere. So I started a blog and started a Facebook page. And now if I'm talking about keto, I only throw it up on my Facebook page. I don't put it up on my personal page. And if folks want to see that, they'll follow it. And that's alleviated a little bit of that. And I support people with a longer reach, I guess, than I have. We've got to change the food industry. And we're not going to do that in our isolated little communities. So it's important to me to support people who actually do have reach. I'm not going to reach 100,000 people, but Daisy Brackenhall might, and Carrie Brown might, and the two keto dudes might. So I put, you know, whatever little resources I can behind folks who are delivering this message in ways that I value, when there's some integrity and some honesty behind it. I follow you guys, you're just important in terms of what you're offering to the world at large. There's a lot of snake oil salesmen in the world, and keto has blown up so big. And there are, you know, for every legitimate person who's just trying to make a positive impact in the communities that they live in, there's 10 people who are trying to get rich quick off of desperate people. And so I just pay attention. There's 1,000 unbelievably good doctors and physicians and experts and life coaches that I could not possibly be aware of all of them. But I think I'm aware of enough that I can, you know, go on my little blog or talk to my friends at a dinner party and say, you know, I really think that you need to listen to the Two Keto Dudes podcast. And this is the episode I think you should listen to. Or I became aware of you, Daisy, because my sister, who has diabetes, she had a weight loss surgery and then started attempting to do some keto. And it looked a little bit different than it does for me. And so I started finding people in the world who had, you know, similar experiences for her, and kind of said, you know, this is where you want to look. And so I became aware of you for that reason. But then I kind of just subscribed to your podcast because I loved it so much. It was just, you have so much more to offer than somebody who does keto after a weight loss surgery.
Well, thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's nice to hear.
You're welcome.
You're very right in saying that we become not shouty about it, but it's so much of a part of our lives. I think a lot of people, I was the same, started it from a weight loss point of view.
That's right.
And you hear people saying all the time, when you start complaining about the weight loss has slowed or whatever, people say, it's a lifestyle, it's not a diet. And I think that's something you don't get when you start.
That's right.
It's something that's very easy to say to new people because you've experienced it. But it's not something that's so easy to hear when you're just starting, when you're starting this new diet and that's the approach you're taking. It's just a diet to lose some weight.
That's right.
And it's only once you've been doing it for a while and all these other things start happening.
That's right.
That are actually more important, that you haven't thought of them as being more important until they start happening. And you start thinking, oh, okay, that's what it's all about. And that's what's going to keep me going.
That's right.
Because I'm the same as you. When my mind feels good, other things will start falling into place. and or I'll just worry about other things less. Mm-hmm. You know, everything went a bit sideways for a lot of last year. And, you know, to the point of just being desperate, really. I just felt desperate, crying all the time and just awful and off the rails as far as food was concerned. And I never thought I'd say it years ago, but the easiest way to stop that downward spiral is to change what you're eating.
That's right.
And because I've done it several times now, I know that that will work. And I know it's just a, you know, a few days of white knuckling a bit, and then I'm going to start feeling better. And as soon as I start feeling better, as soon as my mind starts feeling better, as you refer to it, you just have a bit more bandwidth to start dealing with other things.
That's right.
And things just start falling into place and becoming a bit easier. But you can't be doing these things unless your mind feels okay.
That's right.
Unless you feel reasonably on an even keel. Everything is just too much. You can't deal with it, can you?
No, that's exactly right. Well, and I think that's something that's interesting because, you know, while it is definitely important for me to keep my mind as healthy as possible in order to keep my body healthy and keep my eating healthy, it is very circular. And frankly, when I started keto, I started losing weight right away, but it was the mental clarity and the absence of bouts of depression, the absence of bouts of anxiety that really hit home. I went off within 6 months. I was completely off of any kind of antidepressant or anti-anxiety medication, and I haven't returned to them. Mm. I did start to experience some episodes of anxiety again around summertime, which coincided with the beginning of hot flashes and some other stuff that started going on with me. And I went to the doctor and I said, I think my hormones are messy. And she said, yeah, I think that we're starting menopause here. So
it's just that shift, isn't it, that starts just throwing all the balls in the air again.
Yeah, exactly. But prior to, you know, starting to go a little menopausal, you know, within a month of starting keto, all of the symptoms of polycystic ovarian syndrome were starting to cease. People say that, or people assume that we have diabetes and or obesity and or PCOS and or that all of those things happen because we're obese. When the truth is that all of those things happen when we're insulin resistant, including obesity, sometimes. So, of course, when I lowered my insulin so dramatically and it stayed that way, all of those things started to resolve themselves. And I think that I was telling you this before we got started, the whole world looks at me, or the world as I know it looks at me, and thinks that my weight loss is the most profound aspect to a ketogenic lifestyle for me. And the truth is that the mental clarity and the absence of depression and anxiety is the profound part. Mm. That's the part that will keep me keto for life.
Absolutely.
I've gotten to the point that I am totally intolerant of any kind of mental fog or, you know, emotional apathy or, you know, all of those kind of deadened emotions and heightened sensitivities that happen when you're not mentally healthy. I'm intolerant of it for myself anymore, because the difference is just, my whole life is different. My whole life is different.
And I think also when you were saying before that you've been overweight for most of your life, but always physically active and able to do the things, but the point where it started tipping was where it just becomes something that practically stops you being able to do things.
That's right.
You know, I can remember the same thing. I pushed through doing my gardening work and all those kind of things. And I still did them, but it was well, painful, quite frankly, most of the time. And I used to get welts and sores from all the sort of overhanging bits where it got hot in the summer and rubbed, and used to be so painful. And putting my feet down on the floor when I got up in the mornings or when I'd been sitting for a while, the fat pads on the bottom of my feet are compressed and it was painful. And it's those kind of things that are the things that are the most important things that stop, because they just hold your life up on a basic practical point of view, don't they? They're just,
and
they're the things
that
you don't, but you do once they're gone. And you
That's
suddenly,
right.
Oh, I've just realized, you know, when I get up, I don't hobble for the first few feet because my feet are so sore. Wow, what a difference. Because you get used to all these things, don't you?
That's right.
But like you were saying about, you know, when you were standing doing the washing up and your back used to seize up, all those kind of things, they're just these big annoyances that stop you living your life properly. You must just be back much more to your old self.
That's right. It's really amazing. And so another thing that I've really noticed about going back to those narratives in your head is how much I rationalized previously in terms of what I was willing to accept with physical pain, with physical appearance, with the way the world can treat an obese person, the things that I was willing to ignore and rationalize and create positive storylines around, none of that happens anymore. That takes an immense amount of energy to always be kind of mitigating yourself and your situation so that you can kind of accept your circumstances a little better. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense, but I think that I used to do a lot of excuse making and maybe personality bolstering. Like maybe I was, it's possible that I may have developed such the sense of humor that I have and the kind of social acumen that I have and the way that I portray myself to the rest of the world, you know, funny, intelligent, may even be colored by being obese. Because I think that there was a part of me that felt like I needed to give the world extra of my personality because they weren't getting a good enough physical package. And I didn't even know that I did that, but I did do it. And that all falls away when you get healthy. It just all falls away. And I'm not talking about necessarily about losing weight, but I am talking about the creation of the mental clarity that happened when I got rid of the poison, the dietary poison. It was just profound. It's just been really profound in terms of not only losing weight, but the elimination of other health issues. I don't have high blood pressure anymore. There's just really nothing physically going on with me beyond aging that is
not holding you back anymore.
Yeah, there's nothing. And I have all this mental clarity and energy. I don't get tired of learning new things and seeking out other opportunities. And I don't get exhausted by that anymore. I don't have to feel like I am performing any longer socially. And it's just so freeing. It's just amazing to me how much we as obese people carry around in terms of extra work that we have to do just to exist in the world with some sort of comfort. Mm-hmm. None of that is really playing its part in my life anymore. And that is extraordinarily freeing. Some of the things that have come into play is, for instance, when I was talking about renegotiating the terms of my relationships, you know, people are used to who I was, or people were used to who I was. And so there has been some level of folks in the world talking about, you know, you've lost enough weight now. You really can just go back to having taco night with us. And, you know, you can don't lose too much weight. Some people began, I don't know. There's just, I don't know how to explain it. There's just been in some ways a level of hostility toward me.
Oh, I think a lot of people go through that from well, from various directions. It depends on the individual, but it's something so common. It comes up with so many people that groups of people or one particular person or whoever it is at some point will say to you, oh, don't lose too much weight, or you're losing too much weight now. It seems to happen to almost everybody.
Right.
And it's not about you. It's all about them.
Right. Yeah, I know that, but it's just been surprising.
Yeah, because you'd assume that everyone would just be happy about it.
Yeah. I like to be happy for myself and I like to be happy for other people. I've never really understood competitiveness between people or wishing someone ill or, you know, I've never understood that. I don't know where it comes from, but I do know that it exists and it exists in a lot of places. It's just part of the load that I carry now being a formerly fat person. You know, again, I still have, if you met me today on the street, you would think of me as an overweight woman. You know, I've still got some road ahead of me in terms of losing weight. But if you knew me before, I don't think you'd look at me and say, that's an obese woman. Whereas 2 years ago, you would certainly look at me and say, that's an obese woman. But you would, you know, see me as an overweight woman, which is fine with me. But it's just incredible to me the hostility that I'll get from people who love me, people who claim to love me, or, you know, and I'm not talking about anybody in my immediate family circle or anything like that, but just like friends who maybe we raised our kids together, who, you know, we know we're going to know each other until the end of time. Really hostile sometimes. Sometimes not. But sometimes, yeah, absolutely.
And I think part of the problem often is that people, when they see change in somebody else for the better, whatever form it may take, they can't help but look at themselves.
That's right.
And probably need to make some kind of, for the people who are hostile anyway, probably need to make a similar change themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of feeling maybe that you're judging them, or they're feeling judged, they're feeling guilty, and that creates a defensive position. Mm-hmm. And when you're in that defensive position,
I think you're absolutely right.
You tend to get tetchy and you tend to strike out a bit. That's my theory anyway. It depends on each situation, but I think that's where I say it's all about them. It's not about you. And it's that turning inward and thinking, oh, well, you know, yeah, I should be losing some weight, or but I, you know, I don't feel ready, or I don't want to. And as soon as you get in that defensive position, you start getting a bit angry.
Right. Like maybe I don't even represent myself anymore. Maybe for some folks, I represent all of their own stuff. You know, that's possible.
Exactly. And you know, and you can't be responsible for that, so
yeah,
you just have to find a way through it. But it's difficult because you, when you start these things and when you start having good results and you're feeling really good about everything, you don't expect all these different negative aspects.
That's right.
You don't expect to feel anything but good about yourself. I went through a very difficult period where I'd lost all the weight and was a completely different shape and started to get different kind of attention and being aware of people looking at me in a different way. And it completely freaked me out. And I had to, you know, I had to do a lot of counseling work. And that went back to, you know, something from my childhood. But I hadn't realized quite how protective that layer of fat had been.
That's right.
You know, it served a fantastic purpose for me. And I hadn't realized that. All I'd wanted to do was get rid of it. But what I hadn't taken into account was once that protective layer was down, I'd feel really raw and exposed. And I had to, you know, I had to work through that. But it's not something you'd think of, because all you can think of is, I want to lose weight. I've got to lose weight and then everything is going to be great. You don't appreciate these things that might happen along the way.
No, I completely understand what you're saying. That's absolutely true. And interestingly, in terms of the hostility, I didn't even get it at first. And I think it was because, you know, I mentioned that I've been on all the diet programs. Well, I have, and I did lose weight. Mm. I would lose up to 50 pounds. inside 6 months and then I'd gain it all back. Well, you know, and I'm an excitable person. So while I'm losing that 50 pounds, I'm screaming about it. You know, hey, you guys, you should buy this shake. I'm selling them. You should join Weight Watchers with me, or you should, you know, go to this faith-based program in this church basement with me once a week and, you know, get on this diet train with me. It's the first of the year. and so, you know, the people who have been in my life for a long time have watched me do this 50 times. That's an exaggeration. Probably 10 times, but it never stuck. And that excitability, you know, they'd watch me calm down on Facebook over about 6 months' time. And then pretty soon I'd be at, you know, the holiday party or whatever, and I'd be just as heavy as I ever was. I think people kind of saved their feelings of discomfort around my weight loss for when it started to look like it was going to stick. Mm. The first year I experienced none of that. But this year, it's been different. And I really think it's because people didn't expect this to be any different than any of the other times for me.
Which is understandable.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there have been a lot of changes. I wonder if there have been changes with what your keto looks like.
There have.
I always like to ask people what their keto looks like, but I think it's also really interesting for people who've been doing keto for a while to see how much it's changed over that time, because it usually does.
Yeah. So I started off doing keto with just, all I needed to figure out was get it under 20 net carbs a day and stop using the vegetable oils. Don't buy things in packages. And I was already a cook. So, you know, so this was a fairly easy kind of crossover for me in terms of cooking. We already used a lot of whole foods. We already used a lot of good oils, things like that. But I just, you know, I needed to get rid of the rice and the sugar.
It becomes a bit of a challenge when you're used to cooking and you're used to cooking from scratch.
Yeah.
It's just a different set of ingredients that you've got to use.
That's right.
And quite often it's certainly when I first started, I quite enjoyed the challenge of making a lot of the, you know, keto-fying things.
Yeah.
But that was part of the fun side of it actually from being a cook. But it does help if you have the cooking skills. It does help you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing. And I did do a lot of the keto-fying. That was something that I was doing a lot of. A lot of the noodle replacements with the, you know, the shirataki noodles, the miracle noodles. And, you know, I was ricing a lot of cauliflower and making rice substitutions and all that kind of stuff. And I still do that stuff occasionally, but I tend to just skip it. If I want to have marinara, I don't even bother to kind of noodle out the zucchinis anymore. I just slice them and put the marinara on top of the zucchinis. So it was just your basic, you know, increase the fat, get a lot of calories. I know we don't count calories, but, you know, I was actually making sure in the beginning that I was getting enough food because I didn't have satiety signals. I can just eat and eat and eat. And that still can be an issue, but particularly with certain types of keto foods. But then, you know, it just got kind of streamlined for ease and comfort. And I never intended to fast, even though I had read the obesity code as my kind of my starting point. I didn't intend to fast. It seemed too severe to me. And I didn't intend to do it. Well, shoot, when my appetite started to become so changed, and I would become so full and then not be hungry again for 12 to 24 hours, fasting just became a natural part of my, or, you know, at least if we don't want to call it fasting, that's fine. At least a shortened eating window just kind of naturally fell into place. And so from there, I did start to feel confident that maybe more extended fasting wasn't outside of the realm of possibilities. So I'd say it was maybe 3 months into keto. I started trying out some extended fasting. I started 36 hours and pretty soon I think that like the longest fasts I would do were like 96 hours. I was most comfortable with like 48 to 72 hour fasts. When I lost the bulk of my weight, those extended fasts had to be thrown out the window too. I went to my doctor and said, I cannot seem to get through an extended fast anymore without you know, all kinds of kind of attention paid and work paid throughout the day with electrolytes and salt. And I was just having such a hard time and I'm so hungry again. And he said, you're not fat enough to do those types of extended fasts anymore. You just don't have the calories to draw down from your fat. There's not enough fat. So maybe just, you know, go to intermittent and do that. So now I eat between 6 and 8 hours a day. Once in a while, I'll throw in a 24 or 36 hour fast, but I don't even really try to do those longer fasts anymore because they make me feel uncomfortable. And when I was first doing them, they made me feel great. I don't like to be uncomfortable. No. So I did have to stop the dairy, or at least the heavy whipping cream. I had to stop doing that. It was causing a lot of inflammation for me in ways that cheese doesn't seem to. Even cream cheese doesn't seem to. And interestingly, like even sour creams, things like that, I can seem to eat. But for some reason, that heavy cream just causes me inflammation. That doesn't mean that I don't still sneak it in once in a while. But that's how I cheat now. I cheat with keto foods that don't agree with me, maybe.
Yeah.
That's so funny. That's so funny. So I just have to really, at this point, pay attention to what things can trigger cravings for me, or what things can I eat past the point of satiety. The other day, I made some hazelnut vanilla nut granola that Carrie Brown's got posted on her website. I ate the whole recipe in 2 days. I can't stay out of it. I can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah, I have things like that.
And so that's that. I won't be doing that again.
But that's where it's interesting, isn't it? And that's where you start tweaking. And like you say, just paying attention to things. And there's no harm in trying. And that's where these things, so you feel like, you feel in a way that you're cheating on keto, but you realize that they're the kind of foods that you eat too much of.
That's right.
But the point is, you haven't really done any damage by doing it. So you've sort of enjoyed it when you've had it. You've realized, oh, okay, this is the kind of food that I'm either going to have to save for special occasions because I just eat too much of it, or not eat it anymore. But you haven't done any damage. It's not like you've gone and eaten a load of crappy processed sugary foods. But you've learned something from it and you move on to the next thing.
That's right. Well, and I was always, I think it's got something to do. I think that darn granola has got something to do with my previous habit of eating cereal. And I mean, I could eat a box of cereal in a night, and I always ate it at night. Mm. I'm a night eater. It's still something that I try to tweak around a little bit. I try to move my eating window closer to the morning hours and shut it down earlier because I do like to eat at night.
I struggle with that too.
Close to bed.
Yeah.
It's definitely something that I tweak around a lot with and try to get a handle
on. It's a difficult habit to break, isn't it, that one?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, for sure.
And that granola just felt so much like cereal to me. I would put some nut milk on it.
Oh, that's definitely a nighttime go back for multiple visits type food.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm with you on just that. Like, felt just like cereal eating to me. And it tasted delicious like cereal. Yeah. And it had that crunch and that slight sweetness. And I just could not stay out of it. Well, and it does have to be an every once in a while thing, not because it's going to do damage to me metabolically or in terms of my weight, but because it mimics disordered eating that I used to practice. Mm. And that is not, you know, it's just not on the menu. So I do have to pay attention to that kind of thing because it's very easy for us to, you know, if you're cheating, if I consider myself cheating with keto foods, it will oftentimes have very much to do with that. Like, oh, this is eating, this mimics a negative eating behavior that I used to practice. I'm just very careful of that kind of stuff. That makes sense?
Absolutely. And just becoming more and more aware. Well, it sounds like you've got it down pat.
Well, I hope so.
You mentioned a blog and a Facebook group. Where can we find those? We'll put them in the show notes, but give a mention to them now too.
Thanks. Yeah, so it's just small. I just started it, you know, at the end of summer. So there isn't a ton of content on there, but it's metabolizethis.com is my blog. And then my Facebook page that links to the blog is the exact same name, Metabolize This.
Perfect. Well, it sounds like there's some interesting things to go and read there. I shall go and check it out later.
Thank you. I think that's my story.
Well, you've shared a lot. It's been very interesting. I wonder if you could leave us with a top tip.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, since we're in the new year and people are thinking about resolutions, I think that my top tip would be just what I said earlier, maybe be resolute about building the skill of perseverance, about being curious, seeking knowledge, seeking truth, and really starting to enjoy the process of learning. Because particularly when you're learning to eat differently, it's not a slow process. It's a long process. And we, you know, we spent all of our lives learning how to behave and how to eat. And the expectation that all of that can be resolved and relearned in 6 months or a year is pretty silly. So I think that people should just be patient with themselves and enjoy the journey.
And keep learning. I think it's fascinating how so many people get bitten by the bug of wanting to find out more about why it works. Looking at the science behind it, looking at the articles, watching the YouTube videos, all of that. And I think it helps fuel that perseverance factor.
That's
and the
right.
Interest, being interested in it, being interested in finding why it works so well. I think it just keeps that momentum going, doesn't it? And helps people stick to it.
I agree. Yes.
And become a lifestyle. That's the thing. That's part of what makes that transition happen from it just being another diet that you've tried to, oh, this is part of who I am now.
That's right. Well, and I think that people should also seek a community beyond the one that's right outside their own front door in terms of support for this thing. Bainbridge Island is extraordinarily vegan.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I am like, yeah, people glare at my cart at the grocery store. So we, you know, so we need to seek support and guidance and knowledge from beyond our own front doors. And I think that that's very important. You know, tap into Two Keto Dudes and the Two Keto Forums and Daisy and Carrie and Dr. Barry. And I mean, there's just so many resources out there in every single community, and we can have instant access to them online and on our devices. And, you know, I spent many a 72-hour fast going through Two Keto Dudes podcast archives and just, you know, immersing myself. And it has been, I think it's made the difference.
Yeah, I mean, kind of spoiled for choice now, aren't we?
Yeah.
There are so many things out there that there's going to be something that is good for you that you're going to enjoy.
That's
right. The thing. It's not just like there's just a handful now that everyone's got to put up with the same thing. There's something for absolutely everybody.
That's right. I totally agree. And there, you know, y'all are available to us, and it can be, you know, I read the obesity code that got me on track. I learned a lot on my own and from reading, you know, threads and things like that. But once I hooked into the community, a lot of the loneliness that surrounded this thing that I had undertaken completely dissolved. And that was a huge deal for me. This can be when you are the only person in your family and the only person in your community. And if there are others, you don't know how to find them. It can feel very isolating. And when you feel isolated and lonely in something, it's sure hard to keep doing it.
Mm.
So reach out.
Absolutely. Well, it's been fantastic talking to you today. Thank you for sharing your story, sharing your time. It's been a great pleasure, Brandy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Daisy. It's been great.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share, and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. I asked Brandy for her favourite quote to use as this week's end quote, and here it is. It is from Buddha. You, yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.